August 8th, 1973, Pasadena, Texas. Police responding to the call of a shooting at 2020 Lamar Drive arrive around 8:30 a.m. Three teenagers, two boys and a girl, are sitting on the porch of the house smoking cigarettes in the driveway. A .22 caliber handgun lays nearby. One of the youths, a dark-haired young man with the beginnings of a mustache, informs the police that he is the one who made the call, and that the man he shot is inside of the house. None of those present, save for the mustachioed teen, whose name is Elmer Wayne Henley, have any idea what the man inside the house's death signifies. Henley does, though. He knows that it is the end of a long, dark road, one that has seen him help the dead man murder countless friends for his sick, twisted pleasures. He knows this because the dead man's name is Dean Corll, and he is destined to become one of the most infamous, yet forgotten serial killers in American history. For Dean Corll would go down as the Candyman, perpetrator of the Houston mass murders. Hello again, and welcome to episode 2 of the Deathcast. I am your host through this tour of the macabre, best-selling author Ian Totten. Tonight we are going to be looking at the case of the Houston mass murderers. Before we begin, though, I want to thank my friend, Hollywood Rick, for giving me some ideas for the formatting of the show. And everyone who has listened to the first episode and given feedback. I've chosen this week's grim tale because tomorrow is Halloween, and the man we are going to be talking about is indeed the boogeyman. No, I'm not talking about the kind of boogeyman who lives inside a closet, but the real kind, the kind that steals children, takes them from their parents and their loved ones. Now sit back and relax and prepare yourselves for a story of one man's sick desires run amok. Listeners, beware. Tonight's episode features graphic discussions of violence and sexual sadism that some may find offensive. After confiscating the .22 caliber pistol and placing the three teens in the back of his car, the lone officer headed inside the house. He found a man's nude body lying face down in the hall, his nose pressed into the molding. There was blood all over his back and streaked down the wall. Small red pock marks covered his back and one shoulder. Going back outside, the officer read Henley his rights. Afterwards, the teens supposedly yell, "I don't care who knows about this, I have to get it off my chest." Once at the Pasadena police station, the other boy, a 19-year-old named Timothy Curley, told the detectives that were questioning him as they sat in the back of the patrol car, Henley had confided to him that if they had not been friends, he, meaning Henley, could have gotten $200 for him. This statement puzzled the police and they had no idea what to make of it. They didn't believe the boy or what he had told them took place in the house. While the detectives were talking to his friends, Henley recounted the previous evening's events. August 17th, Henley, then age 17, invited Timothy Curley to attend a party at Corll's Pasadena residence. Curley had readily agreed and they'd gone to Corll's house. They'd hung out at Corll's house for a while, puffing paint and drinking beer before heading out to get sandwiches, before heading back to Houston Heights, where they both lived. Curley parked his car near Henley's home, and they made ready to leave again. That was when Henley noticed the girl, 15-year-old Rhonda Williams, was approaching them from the other side of the street. It was apparent to both of them that she had been crying. When pressed, she explained that her drunken stepfather had been beating her again, and Henley invited her to join them over at Corll's house. They arrived back at Dean Corll's house sometime later, and Corll flew into a rage upon seeing Williams, screaming at Henley for bringing a girl to his house. He soon settled down, however, and by 3 a.m., the three teens were all huffing paint and drinking again. unaware that Dean Corll sat there, watching them, waiting for his moment to pounce. At some point, they had all passed out. Henley awoke to find Dean Corll snapping handcuffs onto his wrists. He had been gagged, and his legs had been tied together with nylon ropes. Nearby, Curly and Williams were in a similar predicament. Although Henley noted, Curly had been stripped naked. Seeing that Henley had awoken, Corll began to berate him, yelling at him about how he had screwed up by bringing the girl into his house, and claiming how he was going to assault Curly before killing them all. It's unclear at this point how Henley was able to convince Dean to bring him out of the room, but Corll eventually did. After stomping Rhonda in the chest, he brought Henley into the kitchen, and Dean further berated him for bringing Rhonda Williams to the house. Eventually, Henley was able to convince Dean to release him, provided that, as Dean raped, tortured, and murdered Curly, he, Henley, would do the same things to Rhonda. Returning to the two helpless teens, Corll lifted them both up and carried them from the living room into his bedroom, where he strapped them to a large piece of wood, which he called the torture board. Handing Henley a knife, he instructed him to cut away Rhonda's clothing while he turned his attention to Curly. He began to assault the helpless teen, while Henley did as he was instructed. There's no real timeline as far as how long the assault of Curly lasted, but eventually Henley noticed Dean's .22 caliber pistol sitting on the bedside table. He grabbed it and turned it on Dean, who supposedly jumped up and began advancing on his young friend, yelling at him to go ahead and do it. Henley yelled something along the lines of, "I can't go on like this, you're not going to kill all of my friends," before shooting Dean in the forehead. The shot did little to deter the man, and he kept advancing, at which point Henley shot him again, hitting him in the shoulder. Dean turned and ran from the room, Henley hot on his trails. He fired multiple shots, hitting Dean in the back and in the shoulder. Dean collapsed to the floor, his face pressed into the molding, the same position that the responding officer would find him in a short time later. Going back into the room, he released his friends and they discussed whether or not they should call the police. Eventually, it was decided that Henley would. The detectives listening to Elmer Wayne Henley found the story unbelievable, even though they were soon to learn that both Curly and Williams corroborated his story. They pressed Henley for further details on how he knew Corll, and Henley explained that he had known the man for roughly 3 years. When questioned further, Elmer Wayne Henley began to elaborate, and the story he unfolded to detectives that morning was beyond belief. Henley claimed that he and another teen, David Brooks, had procured other teens for Dean Corll's sick and twisted desires. He said that initially, Corll had explained that the boys were for the use of a pedophile ring operating outside of Dallas and California, and that all they had to do was get them for him, and he would pay them $200 a head. Dean had told him that the boys would be abused, tortured, and possibly murdered. Knowing this, Henley went along with the plan. Eventually, he learned that it was Dean Corll himself who would rape, murder, and torture the boys. He admitted to helping Dean abduct a few of the victims, before later expanding on this, stating that he had actually helped torture and mutilate 6 or 8 of them. Majority of the victims had been buried in a boat shed in southwest Houston, the few others buried at Lake Sam Rayburn and High Island Beach. Naturally, the police remained skeptical of Henley's claims, which, given the time period, really isn't that unreasonable. The Ted murders were still a ways away, and nobody had yet heard of men like John Wayne Gacy, whom admitted Dean Corll's crimes were inspiration of his own, and actually tie into something we're going to be talking about at the end of the story. Back then, serial killers were a novel term, but Houston had one, they just didn't know it yet. When pressed to give corroborating evidence, Henley began to list names.
Charles Cobble, 17.
David Hillegeist, 13. And Marty Jones, age 19. All three were known to the Dallas Police Department as missing. David Hillegeist had been missing since 1971, while the other two boys had been missing only a few weeks. They conceded there might be some truth to what they were being told. Further lending credence to Henley's claims, the floor in the bedroom where the teens had been held was covered in thin sheet plastic. Also, some disturbing items had been found inside and around the house. There were more rolls of plastic, 8 pairs of handcuffs, various spools of nylon rope, a jerry-rigged radio set to give out higher outputs, a small electrical motor with bare wires hooked to it, dildos, thin glass tubes, a toolbox that had various implements inside of it, and an 8-foot-long by 3-foot piece of plywood that had handcuffs and nylon rope attached to it. Outside in Dean Coral's van, police found the back windows were blocked with thick curtain. Pegboard walls had various loops and hooks hanging from them, a swatch of carpet covered in soil, and a large wooden box with air holes drilled inside of it. Further, on the back part of the property, they found a similar box, this one with human hairs inside. The police were naturally stunned, but there was worse yet to come. Much, much worse. Before we get into that, I think it's important for us to look at the three main characters of this tale. Dean Coral, Elmer Wayne Henley, and David Brooks.
Dean Arnold Coral was born on December 24, 1939 in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He was the first child born to Mary Robinson and Arnold Edwin Coral.
Dean's father was ferociously strict, while his mother could be seen as somewhat of a mollycoddler. Might be because of this home life that Dean was later described as quiet and serious with few friends. On top of his parents' personality quirks, the marriage was rocky from the start, something that was made even worse with the birth of their second son, Stanley. In 1946, the couple divorced. Dean's father was drafted to the Air Force and stationed in Memphis, Tennessee. Not long after, his mother, Mary, sold their home, and they all moved to Memphis in order that their boys could be with their father. Dean contracted rheumatic fever at some point, a fact that was not found until he was in school and it was discovered he had a heart murmur, which kept him from playing in gym class. Dean's parents attempted to reconcile when remarried, moving the family to Pasadena, Texas. Again, the marriage was tumultuous, and his parents divorced in 1953 for the second time. Not long after this, Mary remarried to a man named Jake West, a traveling clock salesman, and he moved the family to the small town of Vidor, Texas, where Mary, perhaps out of boredom, began experimenting with making candies. She would send them with her husband on his route, and he would sell them to his customers. It was through this route that the family's candy business, Pecan Prince, was launched. Dean seems to have been smitten with the idea of being a candy maker, and he spent the majority of his free time helping out. In fact, he and his brother were given the responsibility of running the candy making machine and packaging the product, which their stepfather then sold along his route, most notably in Houston, where the majority of their customers were located. In addition to Dean's newfound responsibilities, in 1954 he began high school. I have read a few reports that during this time he had a few dates with girls, but that beyond playing in the school's brass band, he spent most of his time working for the family's candy company. Work he would continue to do after graduation,
when the family moved outside of Houston. Over the preceding years, their business in Houston had picked up considerably, and they eventually moved the business out from the family's home and into a brick-and-mortar store. Interestingly enough, the candy factory was right across the street from a high school, and Dean took an apartment
directly above the store.
He could be found most days, splitting his time between running the business and entertaining the teens from across the way who came in to investigate. He soon installed a pool table in the back room and would hold large social gatherings.
The Corals hired students from the high school to work at the factory, and beyond one lone instance where one of the students made accusations that Dean had attempted to sexually assault him, there were no other stories coming out. And that student, by the way, he was fired by Mrs. Coral because of the accusations he made. Something of interest during this period is that Dean and a local girl nearly got married. In fact, she ended up asking him to marry her, and he turned it down. So it's almost like Dean was hiding his homosexuality from those around him in an attempt to better blend in, even while hanging out with these teenage boys. In 1963, Mary Coral and her second husband got divorced, and the stepfather kept the business, the Pecan Prince, and the Corals were forced to form their own company, which they named the Coral Candy Company. Dean was appointed vice president while his younger brother took on the responsibilities as treasurer. In 1964, Dean was drafted into the United States Army, and remember, this is during the time of the Vietnam War, and from everything that I could see, he had a fairly unremarkable run in the Army. I believe it lasted around 10 months. He ended up getting a hardship discharge, as he stated he was needed to go back and help run the family business. There has been some speculation that during his brief stint in the Army, Dean Coral had his first homosexual encounter, although I have seen nothing that proves this conclusively. There's also been a few different accounts of Dean telling people when he came back from the Army that he was indeed gay. Again, this has only been posted in a few different places. I haven't seen it on any official court documents or case files, nor have I seen it in any of the various books I read while researching this. So this could just be a case of speculation or somebody trying to get their name in the news. In 1965, the Coral Candy Company relocated to 22nd Street, and this was across the street from the Helms Elementary School. Coral was known to give free candy to the children, and it's because of this that he ended up getting the nickname of the Candyman. In 1967, David Owen Brooks, who was then in sixth grade, became an acquaintance of Dean Coral. Brooks was 12 years old at the time, and eventually he ended up going on trips with Coral to the beaches in South Texas, along with the other kids who hung around the factory. He later stated Coral was the first adult male who did not mock his appearance. Brooks was kind of nerdy looking. Dean took on a kind of fatherly figure in Brooks's life, often giving him cash, and eventually a sexual relationship developed between the two. It's worth noting that it seems almost as though Coral was grooming Brooks. One of the things of note here is that around 1967, Coral began giving Brooks cash and gifts in order to allow him to perform fellatio on the youth. Brooks's parents were divorced and he lived with his father in Houston. The mother had relocated to Beaumont, which is roughly 90 miles to the east of Houston. In 1970, Brooks, who was 15, dropped out of high school and moved to Beaumont to be with his mother, although he would return to Houston quite regularly, hanging out with Coral for the most part, and eventually Brooks moved back to Houston permanently. He later said that he regarded Dean's apartment as his second home. Something of interest here is that the Coral Candy Factory, which had brought all these teens into Dean's sphere of influence, had closed in 1968. His mother and half-sister had moved away to Colorado. Dean took a job at the Houston Lighting and Power Company, where he tested electrical relay systems. He worked this job for the rest of his life. 1970 was an important year in the life of Dean Coral, as it's when he is known to have killed his first victim, an 18-year-old college kid named Jeffrey Coonan, and this took place on September 25th, 1970. Coonan vanished while hitchhiking with another student from the University of Texas to his parents' home. Coral picked him up at the corner of Westheimer Road and South Voss Road. During this period of time, Coral lived in an apartment on Yorktown Street, which was near the intersection of Westheimer Road. Brooks himself led the police to the body of Coonan, which was buried on High Island. It's not known whether Brooks actually participated in this murder or facilitated in any way. However, it is known that around this time is when Brooks became aware of Coral's, the double life Coral was leading, as he walked in on Coral in the act of assaulting two teenage boys who had been strapped to a four-post bed. Now, in return, Coral promised Brooks a car if he'd stay silent. Naturally, Brooks accepted. Dean later bought him a green Chevrolet Corvette, explaining that he had sold the two boys into the aforementioned pedophile ring that was operating out of Dallas. Brooks stated that he later found out that this was a lie and Coral had killed both of them. Dean did offer him $200 for any boy he could lure over to the apartment. And it almost seems as though this is the culmination of the grooming process that Dean has been perpetrating on Brooks. On December 13th, 1970, David Brooks made good on his end of the bargain by luring two 14-year-old kids, one named James Glass, the other Danny Yates, away from a religious rally held in Houston Heights. Brooks knew Glass from school, and the boy had previously been to Dean's apartment. One of the things that Dean would promise the boys was that they were going to party, and just as the night that Dean died, he plied them with drugs and alcohol. Eventually, the boys ended up strapped to the torture board, and Dean sexually assaulted, raped, and murdered them before they were buried in the boat shed, which he had rented on November 17th. Now, there was a cooling-off period of about 6 weeks after the double murder before Dean struck again. Dean and Brooks encountered two brothers, Donald and Jerry Waltrip, walking towards their parents' home. It seems as though they were enticed into the van by David Brooks. Remember, this is Coral's van. And driven to an apartment that Dean had recently rented over on Magnum Road. Again, they were plied with alcohol and drugs before being raped. tortured and strangled, and they too were buried in the boat shed. It's important here to understand Dean Coral. He was escalating in his killings. There's not a whole lot of detail that's available to the public as far as what his torture would involve. Although it is known that he would electrocute the boys with bare wires that were attached to an electric motor. He would also put headphones on the boys and blast extremely loud music into their ears. And this is possibly the worst thing he did. I know earlier I discussed the police finding glass tubes at his house and inside of his van. Well, Dean Coral would take these tubes and he would insert them inside of the victim's urethra before shattering them. I've read a couple of different accounts that he would snap them off inside of there. Others that he would hit the boys on the penis with a hammer. Either way, that's an extremely barbaric, painful thing to do to somebody. So this is the kind of stuff that Dean was doing to these kids that were tricked into coming to his house. Again, he did have a cool-down period. But once this cool-down period was over, Dean's lust for blood took off fairly quickly. It's known between March and May of 1971. He abducted and killed three more victims. So given the time frame of these murders, his cool-down periods are getting shorter. One of the victims was a 15-year-old named Randy Harvey, and he was shot in the head once on March 9th. The other two victims were 13-year-old David Hillegeist, who, if you remember, is one of the names that Elmer Wayne Henley gave police when telling them his story. Hillegeist and another kid named Gregory Winkle were both abducted and killed on May 29th, 1971. The parents of these victims were not taking things lying down. They launched a frantic search for their sons. And in a bit of dark humor, one of the kids that helped look for them by distributing posters was Elmer Wayne Henley, who was a lifelong friend of Hillegeist. Now, there's a long stretch here between the murder of Hillegeist and Winkle. Dean doesn't kill again until the 17th of August, when they run into a kid named Reuben Watson Haney under the guise of coming to a party at Dean's new apartment, which was on San Felipe Street. It's important here to note that Dean is moving around a lot. It's obvious he is aware of what he's doing, so an argument that, you know, possibly he was dealing with some sort of psychosis will fall flat because he's moving around. He's trying to stay ahead of the law and keep people from knowing exactly what's going on. You know, if the neighbors start seeing all these kids coming to the house, they might say something to the cops, but because he's moving around so much, there's less of a chance that anybody's really going to notice what's going on. Now, Reuben Haney was killed much as the others had been, and he too was buried in the boat shed. Now, again, Dean moves in September 1971, so he just moved into a place back in August, and roughly a month later, he's moving again. David Brooks later said of this time that he assisted in the abduction and murder of two other boys at this address, and one of them was killed just before Henley joined the picture. And we can see the sickness that Dean is wrapped up in growing at this point, because this boy who was murdered just before Elmer Wade Henley became part of their group was kept alive for 4 days. That's 4 days of rape and torture before he was murdered. These two boys, however, have never been identified. During the winter of 71, David Brooks introduced Elmer Wade Henley to Dean Corll. Henley was probably intended to be one of the victims for Dean, but for some reason Corll liked the kid and decided that he should bring him into the fold, and he eventually offered him the same fee that he had offered David Brooks of $200, and he claimed that the boys were used for a white slavery ring that was operating from Dallas. By all accounts, Henley ignored the offer for quite a few months, until 1972, when his family hit some sort of financial dire straits, and he decided to take him up on it. This first abduction involving Henley occurred right after Corll had moved into another apartment, this one on Schuler Street, although Brooks has said in multiple interviews Henley became involved in the actual abductions at the residence that Dean lived in prior to moving into Schuler Street. Henley has said that the first boy he helped to abduct took place in either February or early March of 72, and that they picked the boy up on the corner of 11th Street and Studewood, where they lured him to Corll's house with the promise of a party. Now, we're going to see here with this murder the appearance of a trick that John Wayne Gacy would make infamous, in that Henley put a pair of handcuffs on himself and then showed the boy that he could magically get out of them. He did this by having the key in his back pocket. And they tricked this boy into putting the handcuffs on himself. However, it's kind of hard to get out of handcuffs if you don't have the key. And Henley left the boy with Dean at this point, believing that he was going to be sold to this pedophile ring. This victim's identity has never been established. It was a month later, on March 24th, 1972, that the three of them, Henley, Brooks, and Corll, encountered an 18-year-old friend of Henley's named Frankie Aguirre. And it was pretty much the same story as always. Hey, come hang out with us. We're going to go party. And Frankie accepted, following them over to Dean's apartment, where they did indeed begin partying. At some point, Frankie picked up a pair of handcuffs Dean had left hanging out, and Dean pounced on him, cuffing him quickly. Now, Henley has said that he didn't know that Dean was going to do this to his friend. And in a 2010 interview, he said that he had tried to dissuade Corll from assaulting and later murdering his friend. I don't know the truth of this, but it sounds like BS to me, just from what we knew had taken place before this. In any event, Henley assisted the two of them, that being Corll and Brooks, in Aguirre's burial at High Island Beach. So it's apparent at this point that Henley was aware that Dean was killing these boys. And armed with this knowledge, he continued to help him kidnap other kids, and eventually move from, you know, regular kidnapping to actually helping with the torture and murder of the boys. There were a few other murders while Corll was living at Schuler Street, and Brooks later went on to say that Henley was sadistic in his participation in these murders. One incident of note here that took place at the Schuler house is that apparently Henley knocked Brooks unconscious at one point, allowing Dean to assault him before he released, and Brooks came back after this, which kinda is telling of the hierarchy of the trio. It seems that Brooks had become the low man on the totem pole. Coral eventually moved from the address in late June, when Dean moved into an apartment at the Westcott Towers. During that summer, we're talking the summer of 72, Dean is known to have killed two more victims, the first of which was 17-year-old Steve Sickman, and he was beaten about the chest with a blunt instrument before being strangled and buried in the boat shed. The next victim was 19-year-old Roy Bunton, and he was shot in the head before being buried inside the boat shed. Neither Brooks nor Henley named either of these two victims among the list of names they gave, and they were not identified until 2011. On October 2nd, 1972, Wally Simonex and Richard Hembry were coaxed into Brooks's Corvette and driven to Coral's apartment at Westcott Towers. During the course of that evening, Simonex is known to have called his mother and shouted the word "Mama" into the receiver before the connection was severed. The next morning, Brooks accidentally shot Humbry in the mouth with the bullet exiting through the back of his neck, and several hours later, both boys were strangled and later placed inside of a grave at the boat shed. Over the course of the next 9 months, at least 12 other victims were claimed by Dean Coral and his accomplices, with their bodies being distributed between the boat shed and the beach. The following January, this is in 1973, Dean Coral moved addresses yet again to one in the Spring Branch district of Houston, where he is known to have killed one additional victim, a 17-year-old named Joseph Lyles, who was a friend of Brooks. A few months later, Coral vacated that address and moved into his final home, 2020 Lamar Drive. There are no known victims from between February 1st and June 4th of 73. This could be because of a couple of factors. Coral had something called hydrocele in early 74, which is a build of a fluid around the testicles. Another factor is the fact that Henley had moved to Mount Pleasant in an effort to distance himself from Coral. The killings picked back up in June, and according to accomplices Henley and Brooks, Dean was even more sadistic and brutal in his treatment of the victims. They likened it to a bloodlust. A number of these victims were buried at Lake Sam Rayburn, and the dichotomy of the trio changed in July when Brooks married his pregnant fiancée, leaving only Henley to help with the abduction and murders. We can see the escalation of Coral's mania during this point, as between July 19th and the 25th, he abducted and murdered three more youths from the Heights section of Houston. One of these victims, 15-year-old Michael Balich, was the brother of a previous victim, Billy Balich. He was last seen on the afternoon of July 19th on his way to get a haircut. On August 3rd, Dean Coral killed his last victim, a 13-year-old named James Dremala. Now, Brooks did participate in the abduction of this youth, and he later stated that he was a small blonde boy who he had bought a pizza for and hung out with for 45 minutes before Coral attacked him. Something that I think is really important in this case, as it is in a few other cases I will eventually cover, is the fact that both Brooks and Henley stated then, and have continued to state throughout the years, that there were more victims that the police either refused to look for or dismissed as not having existed. You would think that with the amount of boys that they eventually found, if two of the participants are saying, yes, no, look, there are more victims out there, the police would want to go and find these victims and close their cases, give some closure to the family. But that's not the case, and I'm left to wonder why that is. Could it be that they don't want to give veracity to these claims and paint the police department in a worse light than they already are? Or could there be somebody else involved in this thing that we have no idea about who, you know, maybe has some power and the police have just said, look, we're calling it off. We're not going to follow any other leads that are provided to us because this person has, you know, expressed an interest in the case and said, look, that's enough of it. We will likely never know. At any rate, back at the police station, Henley agreed to accompany the police to the boat shed in southwest Houston, where he claimed that the bodies of most of the victims could be found. A couple of items were found in the boat shed. There was a stripped-down car, a child's bike, an iron drum, water containers, and two sacks of lime, as well as a large bag filled with boys' clothing. A Houston police officer described the scene to reporters like this. He, Henley, started to take a step inside the boat shed, but then his face just turned ashen, pale, grim. He staggered around the outside the door. Right then, that's when I knew there were going to be bodies in that shed. Prison trustees began to dig inside the shed, and it wasn't long before they found the first body. The police continued their excavation, and they found a staggering amount of victims. Most were wrapped inside the plastic sheeting. Some had been strangled, others shot. Others still had ligatures wrapped around their necks. All of the victims were later found to have been sodomized, and many of them bore evidence of torture. Pubic hairs had been pulled out, genitals chewed, objects inserted inside of their bodies. Rags had been jammed inside mouths while adhesive tape was wrapped around their heads to muffle the screams. The mouth of the third victim unearthed on August 8th was agape, leading investigators to speculate that he had died with a scream on his lips. Eight bodies were recovered that first day, and it was discontinued until the following morning. That evening, while the excavation was underway, David Brooks presented himself at the Houston Police Department headquarters. He denied any participation in the murders, but admitting to having known that Coral had raped and killed two youths in 1970. Were that true and he had only been found guilty on those charges, it's likely David Brooks would have been found guilty of being an accessory to murder after the fact. The next morning, August 9th, Henley gave a full written statement detailing both he and Brooks' involvement with Dean Coral. In this statement, he admitted to having killed approximately 9 young men and that he had participated in the murders of many others. He also said that David Brooks had only not participated in 3 of the murders that took place in the summer of 73. That afternoon, they went to Lake Sam Rayburn, where 2 additional bodies were found. Inside the small cabin owned by Dean Coral's family, police found another plywood torture board, rolls of plastic sheeting, shovels, and a sack of lime. 9 additional bodies were found in the boat shed that day. Evidently, the things that were found were too much for David Brooks. And that night, the evening of August 9th, he gave a full confession, admitting to being present at several killings and assisting in burials. He did, however, continue to deny direct participation in any of the murders. He stated, once they were on the board, they were as good as dead. It was all over but the shouting and the crying. He agreed to accompany police to High Island Beach the next day to assist in the search for bodies. Henley went with police to Lake Sam Rayburn, where two more bodies were found buried. That afternoon, both Henley and Brooks went with the police to High Island Beach, where an additional two bodies were found. On August 13th, Henley and Brooks again accompanied the police to High Island Beach, where four more bodies were found, making a total of 27 known victims. Although Henley insisted there were more bodies buried out there, the police refused to look any further. The families of the victims were highly critical of the Houston Police Department, something that we would see throughout the years in numerous other cases, such as the Atlanta child murders, where it was almost as though the children were looked at as less than because they were not from affluent families. Henley was brought to trial in San Antonio on July 1st, 1974, charged with six murders, of which Henley was found guilty on all counts. He was initially sentenced to 99 years, which he appealed, stating the jury had not been sequestered. He was awarded a retrial in December of 1978, and in the end, he was sentenced to six concurrent 99-year terms. David Brooks first went to trial on February 27, 1975. He was indicted on four counts of murder, but was brought to trial on only one count, of which he was later convicted to life in prison. It's been said that Brooks showed no emotion as his sentence was read. There have been numerous appeals over the years, but for the most part, their convictions have been left to stand. Henley is currently serving his sentence at the Mark W. McHale Unit in Anderson County, Texas. David Brooks passed away on May 28, 2020, a result of COVID-19. That's not the end of our story, however. There's one last little bit I want to delve into. Remember that initially, Elmer Wayne Henley stated he had been told by Dean Coral that the boys were being sold to a child prostitution ring that was based out of Dallas.
It also had a branch in California.
There is quite a bit of evidence out there to support Dean's initial story. In the late 1970s, a child prostitution ring was busted on North Fox Island in Michigan. And what it was a man named Francis Sheldon had been running a YMCA camp up there, flying disadvantaged young boys out to the island. Long and the short of it is that these boys that were being brought out there were being trafficked to very powerful members of society. Now, this isn't speculation or a conspiracy theory or anything like that, like Pizzagate. This has actually been documented, although the names of his clientele have never been released. And the reason why I bring this up is one of the things that was found in Dean Coral's possession were hundreds of index cards with the names of young boys on them. And not all of these boys were found to be victims of him. He also had a number of magazines and flyers for the organization that Francis Sheldon was later found to be operating. This organization was operating all across the country, It wasn't just in Michigan. They were found to be trafficking boys in places like New York, Los Angeles, and even Dallas and Houston. Conversely, when a search warrant was issued on Francis Sheldon's home after he fled the country, what do you think they found? Index cards with the names of boys from the Houston area, many of whom were able to be correlated with the names on Dean Quarles' index cards. The police never pursued this lead, however, and Francis Sheldon died many years later, still a free man, who was suspected of still being involved in child prostitution and pornography. This is something you guys can out there can Google, and you can read the documents for themselves. As I said, it's not a conspiracy theory. Another tie into this case, remember when I was talking about how John Wayne Gacy stated Dean Quarles was an inspiration of him? Gacy initially told police that he wasn't murdering boys, but he was procuring them for a prostitution ring that operated out of Michigan and California. And one of the detectives who initially investigated Gacy, and later was able to get a court order to look at another piece of property where Gacy and others said more bodies were buried, said that there was evidence that was never presented to the public or at trial indicating that Gacy was indeed sending boys out of state for this prostitution ring. Again, it's not a conspiracy theory. There's actual real documentation out there that proves the facts of this. Whether or not Dean Quarles was actually sending boys to Francis Sheldon or whether John Wayne Gacy was, we probably will never know, but it's an interesting series of connections I thought I'd like to draw out there for you to make come to your own conclusion. So that's it for the second episode of the Deathcast. I hope you've all enjoyed this trip down to Houston in the early 1970s. I look forward to any and all feedback you might have for me. Again, my name is Ian Totten. I'm a best-selling independent author. You can find me on Twitter at Author Totten. On Facebook, just search for Ian Totten Author. There is a Deathcast group that is attached to my author page. If you would like to donate to the show, I am on Patreon at Ian Totten Author. You can also find the 5 books that I have written on Amazon under Ian Totten. That last name is Totten, T-O-T-T-E-N. Sadly, I do not have a recommended book of the week this week. Most of the books about Dean Quarles that are of any substance are long out of print. There are a few that are available on Kindle, which I have read, but honestly, I'm going to say I can't recommend them because they have little in the way of substance. It's more of a bland retelling of the story, which you could go and find on Wikipedia or any place else, so I can't recommend them. However, I am going to recommend a series of books about a case I am aiming to cover this season. The West Memphis Three. These books are Blood on Black, The Case Against the West Memphis Three, and Where the Monsters Go, both by journalist Gary Meese. I recommend these because, unlike a lot of documentaries out there, these books present nothing but the facts as they stand in the case. So if you're interested, you don't want to see a lot of things from Damien Eccles and his various cohorts, you just want the facts as they're presented in the case, from the case files, their books are Blood on Black and Where the Monsters Go, both by Gary Meese. That's all the time we have for this week, and so until next time, stay morbid, my friends. We'll be right back.
to the Deathcast.